Welcome to our Goals to Podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. So hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Goals to Conversation. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here today with Bonnie Greer. This is amazing.
Thank you.
And I have to start, Bonnie, by saying happy birthday.
Thank you. Well, you know, I mean, it is. It is.
It's a significant birthday today.
It is. My name is Bonnie because I was born 36 hours after the present king, because he was called Bonnie Prince Charlie when he was a little baby. And so the name was fashionable when I was born. And my mother never let me forget that I was born 2 days after him, because while his mother, who was then Princess Elizabeth, see, I know all this because my mother told me all this, Duchess of Edinburgh, as she was then, was they were pregnant at the same time. And so there was going to be like a contest where they were going to give free nappies to whoever gave birth on the same day. So, you know, my mother never let me forget that I was 2 days late. So not only was I named after this guy, every time his birthday happened, I had to like have a little cake and celebrate. I had no idea who this person was. Who is Prince Charles? You know, I mean, I didn't know he was his prince's first name. I'm like, who is he? And then finally I found out what happened. And then the funny part of it, when I was at the British Museum, he came in with Camilla when they were still, and she was standing there. And I said, I was born, I was named after Prince Charles. And she laughed so loud. Then she grabbed him and brought him over to me, and she told him that. He just looked like a foundling. So that's my story. You know,
so you grew up in the south side of Chicago celebrating Prince Charles's birthday.
I did. My mother was a royalist. I didn't know what that meant at the time because she loved the royal family. I think a lot of people did. So my younger sister was born in 1953. So of course her name is Regina. I didn't know anything about the royal family. So I don't think that's really that unusual in a sense, you know, people of a certain generation were really into their family. So
yeah,
it kind of like haunted me ever since in a strange way.
Yeah.
Strange way.
So tell me a little bit about your parents, because they sound quite incredible in your memoir.
Well, I was so coerced into writing that book. I will never do that again. But anyway, now I'm looking at my face today in the picture. And of course, you know, as we get older, your face changes. And, you know, I'm starting to look like my mom. And my mother was Willie Mae. She was born in Nashville, Tennessee in 1927. And it's so interesting because I guess this was true of certain Black families, but the light-skinned members of the family, which was, my mother was one of those, and she was born kind of with blondish hair. And then the darker-skinned members of the family, there was actually kind of separation. You know, it was kind of shocking to me when I found that out, that, you know, the lighter-skinned people were more favored than the darker-skinned. You know, growing up in the 60s, that was like a horrible thing to discover. Yeah. So then they moved to Chicago, where a lot of Black Americans moved during that time. Was the end of the Great Migration after World War I. Mm-hmm. Where a lot of Black families and Black people moved off the old Southern plantations, the old Southern places, and moved to the urban North. So you got a huge influx of Black people right after World War I into Chicago, Detroit. I was just talking about Aretha Franklin the other day for a broadcast. And, you know, you have to talk about the Great Migration when you talk about Aretha Franklin, because it's in her voice.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole Philadelphia sound of the 60s and the 70s, that's all the Great Migration. So, and New York, when James Baldwin was born. So my mother is part of that surge. And so is my father, because he was born in 24. So I'm the child of that generation. And I always think it's funny because I grew up on the south side of Chicago, not far from where Michelle Obama grew up. I mean, you know, years later, decades later. And she was a little bit more well off than us. But we were born very much into this kind of Black Southern community, even though we weren't in the South. And I remember I was, I can still see myself walking down Greek Street near where I live in Soho, and this young Black guy from, he was at Harvard. And he said, oh, you really got to get behind this senator from Illinois called Barack Obama. And I said, what's his real name? And he said, what do you mean? I said, nobody born in Illinois is called Barack Obama. He changed his name, you know. No, his name is Barack Obama. I said, that's BS. You know, because that's not, you know, we changed our names in the 60s and the 70s to so-called African name, but nobody born in Illinois. So that was my community. Mm. That was my upbringing. And we, my father worked on assembly line at night for a can company for like 40 years. And so we were very much union people because the union was very important. And he was able to buy some property and for that, a home for his children, and sent us to Catholic schools because that was the pay school for kids growing up in the ghetto. And so I lived in a room with my, we had two big bedrooms and one, three bedrooms, and one for the boys, one for the girls. So I stayed with my sisters and I had my little corner of the room and I could sit and read and write and listen to the Illinois Central outside of the window and think about where is this train going? You know, where is it going? And I was growing up in this very sort of bourgeois for our class community, very sheltered. And I'm grateful for that because it was very dangerous being a Black girl in those days and still is really, but it certainly was then. And so I'm very grateful that my father worked so hard to give us that shelter.
And you grew up in an America where segregation was still in practice, and your father actually grew up in segregation, didn't he?
Well, I was born into it. My father, Ben Greer Jr., grew up in a town that was, they called 9 minutes down the road in Mississippi from where Emmett Till was murdered 20 years, 30 years later. And that's how rough it was. And my father is a very outspoken guy. And in those days, if you were a Black man, you saw a white man coming up the street, you got off the street and you got off the pavement and you stood out of the way. You never looked a Black person in the eye, particularly a Black man. You looked a Black woman in the eye, which Emmett Till did, you could get killed.
A white woman in the
eye. Get killed. And my father was a very outspoken guy. So, you know, if he didn't like something, he would say it. And what I hear is my grandmother said, boy, you can't stay here because you aren't going to be alive. So she sent him up north to relatives. And this was, I think, at the end of the 30s when he was a teenager, because he spoke.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could get killed speaking then. I mean, it's a kind of a racial memory that even though I didn't live it, it's burned into me. Yeah. And it's very much a part of what Black Americans to a certain degree are. I think some of that is being lost and maybe that's okay. I don't know, you know, but I think some of that is being lost. And so, I mean, I consider myself very much a Southern. I mean, I don't even call myself African-American anymore because, when I went to Ghana, I said this to my brother here, Landre, who is an African. You know, he knows exactly where he comes from, and I don't know where I come from. So, and I remember going to Elmina, which is one of the slave fortresses on the coast of Ghana, and it was right before the tourist trade began. Mm-hmm. So it was quite beginning. And I remember going up the steps of the castle and looking over the edge, and you see the Atlantic there. It's very rough. And it's I think there's zero point meridian in the Atlantic there for the Earth. I remember standing there, you know, all the Ghanaians were saying, you're gonna cry. And I did, you know, there was a slave dungeon there and all those things were there. I remember going to the ramparts and looking over the edge, and I thought, gosh, I must have descended from a hell of a people. You know, somebody got on that boat and they lived.
They survived.
They survived it. And so I see myself, I have a scarf that I wear sometimes that Lowry knows very well. It's about a great Guyanese British artist named Frank Bowling, Sir Frank Bowling now. And the scarf is called Middle Passage. And for me, it's like when my ancestors saw the coast of Africa recede, they knew they weren't going to go back there.
Yeah.
And then they had to turn around and face the void. And I think that's where I was born, where I think people in the Caribbean were born. Everybody, South America, all of us who crossed that. So I call myself Black because I think, and it's only recently, because I think for me to call myself African, for me is to reduce Africa to a country.
Yeah.
It isn't a country. I mean, when I talk to Lonnery is Nigerian. Yeah. When I talk to my friends who have Ghanaian roots, they are Ghanaians.
Yes.
I talk to people, you know, but I am this. And I think those of us who are Caribbean background, I'm not Caribbean background, and North American, South American, we had to develop another consciousness in order to survive. So my dad, strange way, because he was very much, he called himself a race man, because in those days, that meant you were for Black people.
Yeah.
He was always very conscious of all of that. So that's kind of like, as I get older, I kind of like refine that a little bit and refine it down so that I see myself as, because of him, as Black with a small B. I'm on the boat. I'm a Middle Passage person. That's how I see myself.
And your dad was really keen on education. I was fascinated by the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Ooh.
You grew up. Tell us about this, that you could educate
really
yourself.
It's like dad, he was an autodidact. So because he didn't have a lot of education, because they didn't let Black kids have education.
Yeah.
But he's big mind. And so he used to get the Reader's Digest. And that's how I first read the books, like James Baldwin. Oh. I read Another Country Under the Covers, which I shouldn't have read. And so you get the Encyclopedia Britannica from door to door salesman.
Mm-hmm.
And we would read it from cover to cover. And I would read it from cover to cover. I was a big reader. And it was illustrated by the British Museum, the objects from the British Museum. I just fell in love with this place. I thought, where is this? It was, you know, all of the different statues and things. And then one day, when he came for the 50th anniversary of D-Day in 1994, because he was a D-Day veteran around that time. It's another story. We didn't go to the British Museum because we thought, all we need credentials to get in here, or, you know, it's like, it's not for us. And then one day, Neil McGregor asked me to join the board.
And what did your family think when there you were on the board of the trustees of the British Museum that you'd been looking at in this?
You know, they didn't know my sort of passion for the museum. So I was stunned, to be honest with you. And you know, to get a chance to see that museum was important. And I was really sad. My father wasn't alive to see it, but I thought about him a lot.
And he kind of got you there, didn't he?
He did, in his way. He always told us, they can take everything from you. I can still see him saying, they can take everything from you, but what you know, they can't take that from you. So that's who he was.
And so when you were a little girl, you were the eldest of seven children.
Still am.
So you had to do lots of kind of like childcare. But you started writing really little, didn't you, when you were very little.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I was a mommy's girl. So, you know, mommy was having children and taking care of babies and, you know, being a proper mom. And I was helping her. And my mother loved dancing. She was quite glamorous. And one day I remember she looked at me and she said, and I thought, oh, wow. And what she was saying is, don't do this.
Yeah.
Don't be a what they used to call a housewife.
Yeah.
So mommy would bring home the groceries and I'd tear the bag open after I helped her put them away. And I would write on them all the time and draw and illustrate. And I love mathematics and writing stories. So that was from a very young age. But I always say to people, especially when I was teaching, you have to pay attention to children because children, that's the shame of not equal education for everybody. Everybody should have what's called a public school education mm-hmm. in this country. Everybody is entitled to that because you never know who's in that class.
Absolutely.
You know, just because this kid grew up in a so-called bad neighborhood or whatever, you don't know who that person is.
Yeah.
And so I'm a really big champion of giving what they call here, you know, you call here working class kids, especially ethnic minority kids, give them the best because you don't know what mind is in there. And when I was coming up in the 60s where, you know, women weren't supposed to do certain things. I wanted to be a scientist. I love quantum physics and all that. I was told by the nuns, learn to type. So I never learned to type as a result.
My mom told me not to learn to type. She said, if you learn to type, you'll only ever be a secretary. Oh, and I always remembered her saying
she's right, which is actually a stupid thing for me to do being a writer.
Me too.
Exactly. But she told me, you know, the nuns said, don't do it.
Mm.
So I didn't learn. But it was very much a traditional girlhood, late 50s, early 60s. And it's partly for protection because Black women were not protected. And it wasn't because the men didn't protect us, because the men weren't protected.
Mm.
So we had to learn to be quite demure, quite conservative, because our fathers could not protect us. If something happened, they got killed. You know, they were killed by the cops or whatever. There was no knight in shining armor for us. You know, so when I was quite young, you know, you learn to be very quiet, keep yourself quiet. So when somebody like Tina Turner burst on the scene doing stuff that, you know, you see in clubs and things, but not in the things, she just was liberating for a lot of us. Very liberating.
And then for a while, you thought about going into the law. Tell us about what happened in that classroom.
Well, this was the end of the 60s. And, you know, the lawyers were sort of the drivers of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people got things done with lawyers and preachers. So every Black kid, I think, in my generation thought seriously about the law because it was the way, because the what Thurgood Marshall in the Supreme Court, first Black Chief Justice, and what the way we were able to defeat segregation was through the law. So the Supreme Court ruled that segregation was illegal under the 14th Amendment, 15th mm-hmm. Amendment. So they had to undo all the laws. So we saw lawyers. And this is, about the end of the 60s when I was at university, and I'll never forget this. I'm married to a lawyer, so he told me this is true. We were in school, we were in a court, and one of the lawyers came in, woman lawyer, in what used to be called a pantsuit. And this judge told her to leave his court because women didn't dress like that. Then I remember being in a class and the teacher said, this guy, very bright guy, about 69, 70. He said, look, he said to us, I'm gonna be honest with you. I don't believe women should be practicing law. Now, this is something that you say now to women. They look at you like, what Stone Age? Well, it wasn't. It was within the lifetime of a lot of us. So I admire people like Hillary Clinton who stayed in the law of that generation because it was tough.
Yeah.
You couldn't practice the law in the United States. You were expected to dress a certain way. And only until recently were women allowed or was okay. I say recently, the last 30 years or so, because I look back now, you look back at television and stuff and you see how women dressed. And we dressed that way because, you were told to get out of space.
Yeah.
So I just thought, wait a minute, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life in a profession where I've got to fight fight to do it. Mm-hmm. So I decided not to do it. But I love the law. I'm married to a lawyer, so you shouldn't say that.
And for a while, you were involved with the Black Panther movement. Tell us about that, because I don't think people over here really understand what the Black Panther movement was about.
Well, I wasn't really a Black Panther. I didn't find out until 30, 40 years later that my brother was a Black Panther.
Right.
I didn't even know. My cousin, I didn't know because he kept that, you know, quiet. But I did know Fred Hampton, who was assassinated by the Chicago Police Department under directions of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. That was a pivotal thing for me in my youth, besides Dr. King being assassinated. And I could have listened to Martin Luther King's voice for 50 years.
Yeah.
And Fred Hampton, we at my university, we decided to lock down the university to teach Black studies, which when I look back on it now, it was kind of like crazy because we didn't have anything to say, really. But, you know, our teachers went along with it. They said, yes. Well, they had to go along with it because we were in the dean's office. We told him he wasn't going to go home until he let us do this. And Fred stood security for us.
Right.
And I knew him because I used to work in his Breakfast for Children's program on the west side of Chicago, really bad ghetto for Black people, and served breakfast to kids who didn't eat breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred Hampton had this program. And I just remember him had these big dimples and he was very, you know, he loved children. He's very gregarious around them. And then when he was killed in his sleep, by the Chicago Police Department, mm-hmm. the FBI. That kind of ended an arc of my life. I was never in the party, but it kind of ended an arc of my life. This is the funny thing. My brother was in the party, my younger brother, which I didn't know. And he said Fred Hampton told them to read the new Marvel comic called Black Panther. And so they were the Black Panthers. They were reading Black Panther. I said to my brother, I said, hey, ain't that ironic? The Black Panthers are gone, but the Black Panther comic strip is still here. So I said, this is something about America, isn't it? It's very bizarre. You know, so for me, Black Panther is like, it's a comic. And, you know, I don't know if it even should exist, but I certainly know the real Black Panthers didn't.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of my story with them.
Yeah.
They were a pivotal part of my growing up, very much so, very much so.
And then when you decided that the law wasn't for you, when did you realize that you were going to write plays and be part of the theater?
Well, I wrote plays when I was 8, but I didn't know you did that for real.
Yep.
You know, because I just did. And I remember I wrote the nativity plays in school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was natural to me. I never saw it as a profession. I kind of like still don't, which is a problem.
I'm going to speak out and say it's definitely a profession.
Yeah, well, I never saw writing as a profession, you know, which is kind of crazy.
Yes.
I still think it, but, you know. And I wrote a nativity play. And I remember, I can still see the nuns. They were Irish, wonderful nuns, whispering among themselves, did she know that? Because what I did was I made Mary pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, my mother's pregnant. I mean, that's what it is. And, and, you know, so I had to walk around like this in front of the students. And so, but I always wrote plays. And I don't know how, but I think I saw a play script when I was little. And I liked the way it looked.
Where it was written.
And so I started to imitate it and copy it. But, you know, as a child, you live in your own world. You live in your own space. Even if it's really hard around you, what's really nice about childhood is that if no one hurts you and you're not harmed, you can kind of like make your space. And if you're lucky, you stay there in a certain way. So I kind of have done it.
And you worked with David Mamet for a while. You studied under David Mamet, is that right?
I studied under David Mamet. And He ran a playwrights workshop and in a theater called St. Nicholas Theater, which Steppenwolf took over after David went to New York in about 1876. But yes, I was one of his people. And it was the kind of theater he wrote was very Chicago style, because we, you know, because Saturday Night Live began in Chicago, so out of a club called Second City. So Chicago was always joking that we called ourselves the Second City, and the next city was New York. Mm-hmm. So there was always a kind of style when you wrote Chicago plays. A Raisin in the Sun is a Chicago play because Lorraine Hansberry was around there, and you know, so it's a style. That's Lorraine, and it's a style of writing that's quite brief and blunt. And I like writing like that.
Yeah. And so, when you decided to leave Chicago, what was it that took you away from Chicago?
Well, I did my first play was produced, and a lot of people were moving to New York in 77 because New York looked funky. I mean, New York was like a mess. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a headline like 10 years before that I hadn't seen it, where the federal government basically told, well, New York print the headline, New York Times, the feds to New York dropped dead. Because New York was like dysfunctional. It was not, you know, it was just mm-hmm. awful. And I thought, oh, that's where I want to be. You know, it's dysfunctional. And so I left with some theater friends and we drove across to Pennsylvania. And I had never even seen an elevation before because I was born in Chicago and it's the prairie and it's flat. So I had never seen even a hill.
And tell us about that car, Jenny, because well, it sounded terrifying.
We all three young Black people. All theater people. So we're up in the clouds, right? And so they were doing coke in the front seat.
Literally up in the clouds.
You know, people. And so and we had all our stuff in the back. I had coats, a fur coat, everything. You know, we were just Chicago Black people going to New York. So they doing this in the front. I'm like, you know, I don't think we should be doing this, but I didn't know the way of getting there. So we're on the highway, and of course, anybody, your parents would have told you, we didn't go anywhere because Black people didn't go on the highway because that's when you got killed, mm-hmm. okay? So nobody was on highways because the cops weren't going to help you. Highway patrol wasn't going to help you, nothing. But we were on the highway with two people doing coke in a car, right? So we came into Ohio, into a diner, and they were like out of it. You know, we television kids. It's like, I ain't going to the diner. And this woman was behind, I remember it was dark. This woman, white woman was behind the counter and we walked in. You know, we're looking good, right? She looked at us. And so my friend, the guy who was with us, a brother, he's going to take charge. He's the man. So he said, we would like some coffees or whatever. We sat down. Next thing I knew, it was like 10 white men in orange hunting jackets with rifles came into that that thing. I thought, this isn't like good. So they came in and they sat at the tables and everything, had their guns on the table. And I thought our parents would have beat us to death before these white men had got us. We're even getting on that highway and thinking we could go there. But we were 60s kids. We thought we could do anything. We thought we owned the world. We were cool.
You should have been able to do anything. I mean, it just
well, we
so
were.
Terrifying.
Yeah, we were. And so we got out of there. I don't know how. And like we're all Midwestern kids. We'd never seen the hills before. So we're coming down through Harlem and it was like this. So we were just amazed and looking at the escalier out there, and it was like Woody. It was like Coming to America. Literally happened to us.
Yeah,
we got out of the car to go and look around. We came back within 5 minutes. That car was clean. There was nothing in that car, and there was no people either. You know, we're Midwestern hicks. So we're like, what? I mean, everything was gone. It was luckily that we had our hand on us. Everything was gone. And people had cleaned out everything. And so I drove into Greenwich Village with nothing but the clothes on my back and my handbag. And I remember I was staying with a friend and I came out that night and I saw these beautiful men on the street and I thought, these guys are gorgeous and they're not even looking at me. I feel so safe here. You know, I didn't know where I was. You know, they were looking at each other. They still were looking at me. It was wonderful to see them. They were all, you know, totally village people, the whole village people. Yeah. Gay and that. And I didn't know I was in the center of gay male Americans. So it was really quite interesting. I had a lot of friends there.
And when you go back to New York now, what does it feel like?
I haven't been back to New York. I haven't been to America since my mother passed in 2016. Mm-hmm. And then my passport expired that year. And then Donald Trump became president of the United States. And I'm telling you, I remember I thought, I'm going to let this passport sit right here because I have another one to travel around. And it has sat there since 2016.
Right.
I don't know what I'm going to do with it. And I shouldn't be so arrogant about it because I know people, you know, take Mexico, for instance, people are sacrificing themselves and their kids to get into that country and to have a passport like mine.
Yeah.
But I don't know. You know,
so symbolic that 2016, you just thought,
I thought, I know there's no way Donald Trump's going to be president. I lived in New York when Donald Trump was trying to get into Studio 54 and all this kind of stuff. You know, we used to call him Don the Con, you know, and you know, it's so, I couldn't believe he was going to be president. I thought that was a joke. And then finally,
I think we all did.
Yeah. They finally showed him looking up at the screen and it said he won. And I just literally turned my face to the wall. Yeah. I thought, oh my God, this con man has conned him into be president of the United States.
Yeah.
And he's trying to do it again.
Yeah.
But he's not conning anybody this time. He's just being the psychopath that he really is.
Exactly. We want to hear it like it is.
Yeah.
So you were in New York for how many years before you then?
I came to New York in 78. And most of my friends in New York at the time were gay males. So I knew all of that scene. I went to Studio 54. I went to the garage. I was there for Grace Jones' baby shower. I remember that. And, you know, you just, you know, at the beginning of rap, Grandmaster Flash, I knew I lived on in the East Village. You just call it the Spanish call it Luiseda. So you live in Luiseda near Tompkins Square Park with the Ukrainians and the junkies. You know, you always found somebody from uptown in the garbage can dead from the night before because they would come down to our part of the town to score. And then, of course, they got all the bad stuff and they died. So, you know, it wasn't unusual to wake up in the morning and say, oh, hey, I found somebody dead in the garbage can from East 75th Street. And, I was there when John Lennon was assassinated.
Yeah.
And that was like, you know, it's one of those moments where you look at the clock and see what time it was and where you were. And I thought, John Lennon dead. And with all the partying, I didn't do drugs because I couldn't do drugs because I don't have that kind of body. I just couldn't do it. But I belonged to the Actors Studio. I was playwriting and director's unit. And I also worked with Joe Papp. And Kevin Spacey was in the Xerox room making copies, telling everybody he was an actor. I'm like, we all are, baby. So, you know, and you know, going at the Actors Studio when Elia Kazan was still alive, Joe Mankiewicz was still alive. All these people from the golden era, the 50s, were still alive. Norman Mailer and Elia put on a play, a version of Oedipus at Corinth, because because Aaliyah had testified in the 50s against some of those people who were there and they lost their careers. So, you know, I'm a kid, you know, I love movies. I'm telling one of these old timers, and I really love On the Waterfront, you know, the Marlon Brando film. And these guys say, yeah, that's the stool pigeon movie. I said, what? And then I thought about it. Yeah, it is. Marlon Brando rats out these junior people. But I didn't, you know, you don't look at it like that.
Yeah.
So I was a part of that. I was a part of, then I met at the Public Theater, the Royal Court Theater came over and did a lot of plays. So I got to know London that way. And then the revolution was meeting Mustafa Matura because we both got a play award together. And Mustafa brought over a play. I never met anybody from the Caribbean before. Because for us growing up in America, the Caribbean is where you had like these people with white gloves and they had tables with drinks with umbrellas on them and stuff. And Harry Belafonte singing and all that. I didn't know anything about the Caribbean, you know. So I was amazed to meet him and to meet this crew of young Black men who were not only beautiful, but I had never in those days seen such diversity in the Black community because all of us were Southern.
Yeah.
So here are people from the Caribbean, people from Africa, and they're all together. I thought, I got to go to London. I got to go there because I've never seen Black people so many communities. So I thought I should move there, especially because so many of my friends were dying in the AIDS epidemic. It's so many friends. And I thought, I got to get out. This is a city of death.
Yeah.
So I got to get out. And I came and did the Edinburgh Festival. And then...
And tell us about Edinburgh Festival and the play you did there.
Okay, I'm moving from New York, right? A very rough place. And with two friends came over. Two stories about that. One day, I was waking up and I saw this milk wagon. And these guys were jumping off the milk wagon with this milk. So we're from New York, right? So we're standing there looking at this. I says, we should call the police. I mean, because... And they were jumping off and running with milk. And so, so we were sitting there, the three of us going, I don't know where the police are. I said, well, they got to have police. And I said, they got to have police. These are my three running stories. So I'm looking, and these guys just jumped off and ran off. So I said, we got to call the police because they're taking this man's milk, okay? Luckily, one of us went outside and said, excuse me, what you doing? He says, what? I said, what's happening? Oh, we're delivering milk. Okay, so then the next story is we were coming home from the theater one night. And you know how Edinburgh's got hills? And people were running up and down the hills and stuff. They said, we were coming from New York where it's mayhem, okay? We said, there's something that's going on here. What's happening? And so we hurried down the hills. The pub was closing. We didn't know what it was. And then my other story was my London story. They call these my running stories. So I'm coming down in the tube and everybody's running and people have got like mugs of beer and they're running. So I'm from New York. I'm like, oh shit, let me just join this because I don't know what happened. So I'm running with them, running through the tube, and I jump on the tube and I ask this guy what's happening. Oh, he said the pub's closing. And he said the tube stopped running. I said, the tube stops running. I said, do you mean the elevator? It's the train stops running. The train stops running. They said, yeah, it stops. Because nothing stops running in New York.
Exactly.
Oh, come on. Like, whoa. So, I call those my three running stories. So that's... That's how I got acclimated into New York. But the thing I didn't tell you about Oedipus at Colonus, so Aeneas stages his version of Oedipus at Colonus, modern dress. The chorus were all the guys all the guys he accused at UAC were the chorus. Every one of them came back. They put on trench coats, hats. I thought, well, you either got a lot of guts or you are really trying to expiate your sins. Every last one of them lost their careers.
Wow.
Because of him. And I got to know Norman Mailer, who was a really big champion of my works. When everybody puts Norman down, and he was a misogynist, but he liked me. And he helped me. Him and James Baldwin got the big fights, but he helped me, believed in me. And so that's what I tell people. Life is a bizarre thing, you know.
And then you got to Edinburgh. Tell us about the play that you did at Edinburgh.
I did a play called Desdemona, She is Black. And I made her black, mm-hmm. and I put her in a boxing ring, and Othello wasn't in there at all, but she was in there,
mm-hmm.
and she did all the lines, and we did this play, and we brought it to Edinburgh, and everybody liked it. I didn't realize you didn't make any money at the Edinburgh Festival. You had to spend money,
mm-hmm.
and but it was good. It was good in those days to be there. I really love Scotland, and when I get an honorary professorship from the Royal Conservatory, I was really chuffed because Scotland was just really amazing in terms of being an artist, being a writer. But it's very difficult, you know, when you're an American. And this is the thing, I say the most American thing about Black people in America is that we think we can just up sticks and go somewhere and live. You know, you always see Black Americans go, I'm going to go live in Paris. I'm going here. You know, and that's American. We think we can just go. And then you go, and then you find out that you're a foreigner. Mm-hmm. You're a foreigner to Black people. Mm-hmm. And I remember being in Brixton. I haven't been in Brixton a long time, but in those wonderful days. And I said, I asked for something. And they started making fun of my accent. Oh, the Yankee. Blah, blah. I said, I'm not Yankee. I'm from, you know, a Yankee. Yankees were white people.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what they were talking about. Call me a Yankee and blah, 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 blah. And it's those kind of shocks.
Yeah.
That because we're Americans and Americans are taught you can do anything you want. You can be anything you want. You can go anywhere you want. And as bad as it is in America for Black people, I still say to people, you know, y'all think you can just come out and go live in, you know, Sao Paulo or something. And they do, but that's an American thing. So I thought I could live in London. And I found out that I was from another place. Mm-hmm. And yes, we have the same color of skin, but I mean, I even got into a fight with somebody who said my people were from Jamaica. I said, they're not. He said, everybody is from Jamaica. I said, but I am not. I said, I promise you. Yes, yeah, I know your people. I said, no. But I didn't know that there were people from the Caribbean who pretended to be Americans.
Right.
Back in the day. Because that gave you agency. Wow. It gave you freedom to pretend to be a Black American. The same thing in Paris, you know. Because to be a person from the Caribbean or from Africa to have an accent was bad, but to be an American was good. Mm. So some people would pretend to be American. So I'm saying, I'm not pretending. I'm like, I've never been to the Caribbean. I don't know. Yes, I know your people. So, you know, but I didn't know the genesis of that. You know, so it's kind of like still, I think for younger people, it's easier for me to be me. But I think people in my generation and a little bit younger, it's harder because the travails that generation of Black people went through, I did not go through those. And I do know, and I've learned, you know, because of racism and this country is very America-centric, that at the beginning, some doors were open to me because I was an American.
Yeah.
I mean, I had to go to the BBC pronunciation unit. Now, people think I'm joking, but it existed.
Right.
Where I had to learn how to say my vowels a certain way and make sure, because, you know, Americans don't pronounce consonants or anything. So I had to do that. But I didn't know, because everybody was a Black person to me. I didn't know, because I wasn't in the community, of how they were playing racial politics.
Right.
And how some Black Americans took advantage of it. And they weren't totally aware. And then you think of the Black British people who go to America. And, you know, of course, they hire, you know, this one guy told me, yeah, they hire Black actors because they're cheaper. And then there's a resentment in America for Black British actors. I mean, the whole Wire was all British.
Insane.
You know, it's so yes. And there's really resentment. And you can't
got to.
You can't explain it.
Yeah.
If you're not in Britain.
Yeah.
And you can't explain to African and Black Americans that this is the way the business is structured. And you can't tell somebody who's young, who's ambitious, who's good. And anybody can do an American accent because you grew up doing that. Mm-hmm. You can't tell people don't go to L.A. Because that's where their work is.
Yeah.
You get more work in L.A. But then you're taking work as well. So that's kind of like the dynamic that I live in a kind of way.
And so you've written for the theatre. You've written your autobiography, which you said you'd never do again.
No, I was coerced.
Okay. You've written novels. Tell us about the different writing forms. Do they all appeal? Is there one that appeals more than the other? Than others?
I think a piece of work announces what it is, and you don't tell it what it is. Mm-hmm. I'm not a professional in the sense that I have a big agent, I don't have one at all, and you know, publishers or anything to say, you have to do, then this is the next thing you do. I think a piece of work just tells you what it is. And then you have to do it I mean, you can be a hack, and I got nothing against hacks because they eat. But you know, you can be a hack and just do the thing.
Yeah.
Or you can follow the work, and you can be either contemporaneous or you can be posthumous. Mm-hmm. You know, the work defines everything, and the work decides. And I'm glad I'm saying this today, because you know, you always have to follow the work, I think, at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about Ella Fitzgerald and Marilyn Monroe and this story that I found so fascinating.
We used to live in Holland Park. In fact, my husband's in France. And I said, do you want to move back to Holland Park? I thought that would be really nice. I was looking at this. And he goes, no, I live there. Okay, so anyway, I was looking at a show about jazz. And up came Marilyn Monroe. And these jazzmen, black jazzmen from back in the day, were talking about how Marilyn used to go to 58th Street, where all the jazz scene was, and Marilyn hung out. Mm-hmm. And they were saying she was really cool. She was cool. And I thought, Marilyn Monroe. And then there was a picture of her and Ella Fitzgerald, that famous picture. Mm-hmm. And it said that Marilyn got Ella a gig at Macombo, which was the big nightclub in L.A. in the 50s that didn't hire black people, which was not true, mm-hmm. because Eartha Kitt had performed there. Sammy Davis Jr. performed there. So that wasn't true.
Yeah.
What was true was that Ella was not the Hollywood shape. Mm-hmm. So she didn't get employed there. Eartha was, you know, like this. So, you know, she got the job. So I thought, Marilyn Monroe and Ella Fitzgerald. And so I started doing some research. And it turns out, I mean, the more you learn about Marilyn Monroe for real, mm-hmm. you see what a genius she was. She's an amazing person.
Yeah.
And she was a stammerer. So what she used to do is listen to Ella Fitzgerald records for diction. And Ella Fitzgerald records calmed her down. Mm-hmm. So she adored Ella Fitzgerald. So she found out that Ella, who wanted to be a movie star. See, this is the thing that's interesting. Marilyn wanted to be an artist, and she was. Ella wanted to be beautiful. That's all she really wanted. Ella, your voice. She said, that voice is from God. That's got nothing to do with me. You know, that voice comes out of me. That's God's voice. I didn't do anything for that voice. She wanted to be skinny and be beautiful. That's all she really wanted. And she wanted deep, true love. That's all she really wanted. And Marilyn wanted to be her, a great artist who could stand up. She had perfect pitch. Ella had perfect pitch. And there's another thing that's perfect in musicians they had, where the orchestra tuned themselves to her. She was never off pitch. Never, 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 never. I mean, the Philharmonic tuned themselves. The lead violinist, who's the leader of the orchestra, tuned himself to Ella's voice.
Wow.
So she could drop, you could drop this spoon on this plate, and Ella knew what pitch it was. She knew what note it was. She knew everything. And she could imitate it. But all she wanted to be was beautiful, like Eartha Kitt, like Audrey Hepburn, which were the beauty symbols mm-hmm. of the day. So I thought I should write a play about this, because and I've written several versions of it, and you get into a situation where people are impersonating people, and it's mm-hmm. not on purpose, they just do.
Mm-hmm.
And you do, because that's the business. And but nobody can be Ella. Nobody can really be Marilyn. So the next version of this I'm going to do, they're not going to look at them at all, mm-hmm. because you can't do it. It's not possible. Ella was, Ella Fitzgerald's voice was an extraordinary instrument. She was a genius. And Marilyn was, she converted Judaism because she married Arthur Miller. She was on the left, because she was going out with these guys, and she would hear things, and she would go tell all her socialist friends, watch out, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. They never busted her because she was making too much money. She was what they call a car girl, because when she started out, she's a natural redhead. So she changed her hair color, which was a lot of work, because she had to bleach her hair. And she went out with these guys because that's what you had to do. she was called a car girl, which meant you had sex with them in the car. I mean, they didn't even have, I mean, she never had a real home. Mm-hmm. She went into movies because she was a fostered, and she was trying to get out of foster care. She's a beautiful kid, and then, you know, she was abused. Mm-hmm. So they married her off early so that she wouldn't be abused. But she was abused anyway. Ella was abused. In fact, Ella wanted to be a dancer. And Ella came on stage at the Apollo. And I don't know if any of you know the Apollo, but that's the place where you come on stage, you got about 5 minutes. And then the audience is like... And then they had this thing, and used to be in vaudeville, they had a hook, a hook. And it's called, and the guy would yell, "Get the hook," and it would come out of the stage, and you would be taken off the stage while the audience was going, "Nah." So Ella came out, and she wanted to be beautiful, so she would dance. And the guy in the back was going, "No, you can't do that. Can you sing? Can you sing?" And then she stood on stage and started singing, and the audience.
Wow.
So these are like, these women, I think as a playwright, you try to find in the characters what is speaking to you. And sometimes it takes a long, long time to discover because it's probably true of life. You know, you have to listen a lot. And we aren't trained to listen. So the theater as a playwright requires you to listen. It seems like the opposite, but it isn't. You have to listen.
And what do you think that age and experience has taught you compared to your earliest career? Because we're celebrating significant milestone birthday for you today. Do you think that aging has helped your writing? Do you think you'd look at things in a very different way now?
I think that turning 75 years old, you know, you think, you know, when you are not 75 or when you're not 50 or 60 or 25 or 22, you're younger. You think, when I get to be, I can still remember thinking, when I get to be 16, you know, now I can like, I'll be able to go into the movie house by myself and I don't have to take my parents. Or when I get to be 21, I can like sign this and I can have all this. 30, you know, that's why I really got to be mature, you know, and when I was growing up, never trust anybody over 30. So that was old. And, you know, so I thought, oh, I'm going to really be there. Then you get to be 40 and you think, yes, you know, now everything's going to happen. I won't fail or everything. Then you get to be 50 and you think, yes, this is it. So all of these things happen. And I think what I would say is that you realize the it that you think is going to happen never happens. And the second thing is that the it that you think is going to happen is always happening. And it happens from when you're a little one.
Yeah.
And it's happening now. And the bad thing about it is that you start seeing cycles repeat. So you think, haven't they like learned this lesson? I mean, this won't work. But people do it anyway because people have to find out themselves.
That
won't work. So I think you learn a little bit more semi-indulgence, but you also become more impatient because there's only one thing we know in this life. There's only one thing. And we don't know anything else. And it must be amazing, I think, as a species, then maybe we're the only species that knows that we're going to come to an end. And I don't know if any other species knows that, but we know we are. And so it becomes an interesting point where you think, and I don't think about legacy because I think legacy is arrogant. I have no idea what anybody's going to do after I'm dead. I mean, you know, it's like Orson Welles said in The Third Man, where they thought he was dead, you know, as Harry Lime. And Orson Welles is on the carousel with Joseph Cotton. I love movies, old movies. And Joseph Cotton says something to Orson Welles' character, and Orson Welles says, "Well, I'm dead, old man." You know, I mean, I don't know. So, you know, so I think you just, you know, you just live your life because that's what you've got presented to you. And, you know, you carry, you know, you get older and you see your parents coming through or your auntie or, you know, people you didn't know come through your face and your body. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. But as a writer, I feel starting to learn how to do it. And I'm just starting to understand. I'm writing a book about James Baldwin and the time I met James Baldwin. And it took me 50 years to admit that I did.
Right.
And so.
Wonderful. That'll be amazing. I can't wait to read that.
Well, I had to learn to put myself in it. I didn't want to, but I had to learn to do that. I have to learn to do that. And so that's how I think writing is. You're a writer because that's what you are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You don't have any other choice.
Agree.
It's not, I mean, some people learn to write and some people be, you know, for gigs or whatever, but I think you are, that's what you are.
I want to invite Tricia up, if she's happy to come up.
Oh, she's creeping
she's
away.
What are you doing? So, and do you want to explain to everyone, Bonnie, why we've got Tricia coming
Tricia,
to join us?
Tricia, come and sit here next to me.
Come and sit with us.
Come sit here. I was going to wear my black too, but someone told me to wear blue. But okay, this is the story. This is the story. So I met Tricia, like at Landre Studio. So, you know, I was told that this is going to be on the 16th of November. I thought, oh, God. I said, that's my birthday. And Tricia said, it's mine too. I thought, what? I never met anybody who was born the same day as me. But this is the beautiful part about it besides. She was born on my 50th birthday. And this, and you know, 50, if you're married for 50 years, it's your golden wedding anniversary. It's golden. So she's my golden present. And, you know, and I wear black all the time. And today I decided not to wear black. And so she's like, I feel that she's a great birthday present because, you know, it's you know, you get to be, I really love this generation of people. I really think, Zoomers are going to be incredible people. They've got a lot to contend with. They've got a lot on their plate. You know, hopefully, you know, I will be able to, and my generation, you know, some of us are in this room, you know, that we'll be able to leave something for these people. Yeah. And so I'm really like thrilled that there's actually a Zoomer who is like, you know, like, oh, we can celebrate birthdays on the same day. So this is, so hopefully we get to be in conversation with each other sometime.
Well, I hope and so. We're going to make that happen. We're going to make
it. Yeah, so that's good. So this is my
birthday girls.
This is my 50th birthday present is you.
Thanks.
So thank you.
And happy birthday to both of you. I could keep talking for ages, but I know we've got like a minute left. And
I forgot it. It's time.
I know. I'm sorry, Rob. Thank you so much, Bonnie. This has been absolutely amazing. And for everybody who's here in the live audience and for all of you watching on Zoom and for anybody who's catching up later on, it's been such a privilege. And
thank you
for
asking.
She's going to make a little birthday presentation.
Flowers.
So
thank you. Thank you all. Thank you. This is beautiful. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And everybody at Riverstone, we want to say thank you so much, Bonnie, for coming and doing this.
Thank you.
On your birthday particularly.
Thank you.
Do join us again. I'm back tomorrow on the Goldster Book Club. I'm talking to Lee Jackson, author of Dickensland.
Yes.
Check the Goldster website, goldster.co.uk, for everything else that's coming up. And next month at the Riverstone Live, I will be here with Andy Yao, our wonderful Tai Chi teacher. So take care, everybody. Have a great weekend.
Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt GOLDSTER. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.